episode 57, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Jake Yocumpayat, co-founder and project lead for Decred and CEO of Company Zero. The team discuss cryptocurrency, encryption standards, and the threat of quantum computing to the blockchain. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how you doing?
Hey, Patrick. I'm doing well. Looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
And you won't be disappointed. Today, we're joined by Jake. Jake, do you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Of course not. My name is Jake Yocumpayat. I am a founder of the Decred Cryptocurrency Project. I'm the CEO of Company Zero, the lead contractor for the Decred project, and I've been working in the cryptocurrency space since early 2013. Worked on Bitcoin for a while, and then I've ended up pivoting to do my own cryptocurrency project.
A real pioneer. So this is a question we hear a lot. So Cyprian, last conference we were at together, I remember several people, if not dozens, coming and saying, "So how's this impact crypto?" And of course, cryptocurrencies use a lot of encryption. It's in the name. And so you guys are cognizant of that. Is that something that's widely done in the industry, or are you the tip of the spear in this regard?
I believe we're mostly the tip of the spear. There's little bits and bobs where people talk about post-quantum security. In our case, what we had observed is basically that a lot of the tech that people build on chain relies very strongly on elliptic curve cryptography and then the homomorphic properties of it. So, for example, when people talk about things like confidential transactions or ring signatures, like they use in, for example, Monero, that depends very strongly on elliptic curves. And then so a lot of the blockchain space really depends on elliptic curve cryptography and not so much post-quantum stuff. So what we did is we saw an opportunity to say, hey, we can add some security and privacy to our project by using post-quantum, post-quantum PKI, and do that in a way that didn't really impact us from a chain bloat perspective.
Now, I assume you were watching the NIST. I won't call it a circus, but it was definitely fun to watch as it unfolded. As they picked their finalists. So for the key encapsulation mechanisms, we've got Crystal's Kyber, a nod to Star Wars and lightsabers everywhere. And on the signature side, we have Crystal's Dilithium, as well as some other implementations. So is Crystal's factoring highly in what you're doing, or are you going with something else that's post-quantum?
We had decided, I guess the post-quantum stuff is actually more recent. We implemented it and deployed it like January of last year. So it's been in production for a solid year at this point. And we went with NTRU Prime. And my justification is that as much as I know that, the standards process to some people is like, the golden standard, I'm a bit more skeptical of it in the sense that, I don't place too much faith in NIST because I feel like it's sort of just an extension of the NSA. So where the objective is really to create something that's secure enough for everybody, but maybe it's not the best choice.
That's still a lattice-based encryption, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so you've gone with the family. I agree with you that if you want, it's like the old IBM adage. No one gets fired for buying IBM. No one's going to get fired for using NIST. But there's many good encryption standards that aren't going to be part of the NIST standard. NTRU is one that I've kept a good eye on as well. One of the things that's a challenge is trying to help people understand it. It was a lot easier to explain RSA, and even elliptical curve is kind of hard to explain, but some of these crystals things are really deep. Did you have to go far afield to find the expertise to be comfortable with the technology?
Not especially. I've always worked with a number of people who both who have a history doing kernel hacking and user land hacking for open source operating systems. Historically, I've worked with people who are either former or current devs of the OpenBSD project. And so I've been working with these guys, some of them on and off for past, 15 years. So it's been a while. So I have people who can take a either an algorithm or an existing code and transpose it depending on the the language du jour. So in a lot of cases, these implementations are written in C or C++, and then we would transpose it into Go, which is our language of choice.
So Cyprian and I are both programmers. Me more in my deep dark days, and him more in his day to day, I think. Why Go?
We like Go from the perspective of code readability. I mean, I feel like really when it comes to computer security, readability of code is sort of king as far as things are concerned. I've seen enough code go, sit and mold. I mean, I've had people find bugs that are 20 years old in Xterm. Yeah. And it's like, the reason people don't find these bugs is because the code really isn't very readable. And, so you need to be able to, be familiar with different styles. Yeah. You need to be familiar with different practices, different, some people don't have any comments. And so one of the things that we think is good about Go, particularly in comparison to C, we used to be a C shop, and this was like 10 years ago, is just that people who aren't as technical can really, without a whole lot of trouble, read the code and follow what's going on. And that really speaks to the readability in my mind.
I'm having Visual Basic flashbacks, because that was the big strength of Visual Basic back in the day, which is the programming language I did the most code it with in the early, in the late 90s.
Funny that you mentioned that, Patrick, because I remember back in the days of printed magazines, there was always this challenge where they were taking like a piece of C or C++ code, remove all the white spaces and delimiters, right? And then the challenge was to figure out what that piece of code was doing, right? Speaking of readability.
I think that's defined as Mission Impossible. I'm going to have to check out Go then, because I do like a good readable language. So Cyprian, this, I know you guys at your company, Soliance, you do a lot in the crypto space. You've even had a conference. Is this something?
So this discussion was starting. I was wondering, like, Jake, what do you see in the broader community of blockchain and distributed ledgers, right? Like, what is the overall temperature with respect to the potential threat of quantum, right? Because we know quantum, the immediate threat, right, is RSA and essentially the public-private kind of key cryptography thing. In general, we believe hashing is more safer at this point, but we don't know what we don't know, right? So it might be that 5 years from now, when we have a 5,000 qubit working quantum computer, that optic could change. But I would like to understand a little bit, how is the broader community looking at this? Is there a concern? Is there, because one of the things that we also see, and Patrick and I have talked quite a lot about it, is the collecting data now, hoping to crack it later, right? And I think that a technology like blockchain, right, could be under threat with that approach. I've seen discussions about the risk of getting forks and things like that at some point. So I would like to get your kind of overview on what is the temperature on quantum menace, so to speak, in the world of blockchain.
Okay, so I think that this kind of connects back to what I had started to get into earlier about the homomorphic properties that people use with elliptic curve cryptography. So my read is that really throughout most of the space, there's not much. People are aware of the threat that quantum computers pose, particularly to privacy or even to spendability or security. So there's awareness, but I feel like there's really no sense of urgency from most projects when it comes to adding post-quantum security to their models. That is that most people are they're fully content to, whether you look at Taproot on Bitcoin or, confidential transactions on Monero, people or whatever it is, or what is it, ZKPs on you know, on Zcash, people don't seem very concerned with the post-quantum component. So they're content to go, okay, listen, I'm more concerned about, say, the size of my blockchain and the size of my, you know, of my range proofs or the size of my ZKP, my zero knowledge proofs. They're concerned about those things because that is really to the average user what's more tangible. However, as you point out, I mean, it's like, the issue with a quantum computer is that there's, you know, there are state actors who are highly incentivized to keep these, you know, these kinds of tools under wraps. So, you know, say decrypting government comms is probably very high on the list. And, you know, cracking cryptocurrencies is probably lower on the list for most of these people.
Except maybe North Korea and Iran, because the money, I mean, North Korea has been using crypto. They have interest in it. If they can, you know, if they got a bug that they could exploit, they would steal billions, if not, you know, tens of billions. So I think you're right. It is a real threat. But I guess the big question is, the way I rephrase this, if I can get it out of my own way, is what brought you to prioritize this threat? Since a lot of people are like thinking that this isn't going to happen for decades. I don't agree. I think it's by the end of this decade, it could seriously be a threat. What made you prioritize this?
Well, what led me to prioritize this is that we actually had a history of proactively implementing this stuff. So we had been working on we had our own internal comms system that we called ZKC, Zero Knowledge Communications. And that uses, you know, I'd expect you or your viewers are pretty familiar with Signal and how it uses this thing called the double ratchet. So that basically there's entropy that's generated on both ends of communications, and then it has both forward and effectively, you know, reversed secrecy. So we built a communications platform based on that. And then when we saw NTRU Prime came out, I read the paper. I felt like, you know, the justifications delineated by DJB and his co-authors were sound. And then on that basis, what we did is that we added that to our communications platform. So
nice.
What we did is we saw, hey, this is kind of low hanging fruit. So like, let's change the the key exchange process a bit and make it post quantum because it's not that much work. So I had put in somebody put in like I think it was like 6 or 9 months of dev time on it, and then boom, we have post quantum secure comms.
Nice.
And then from there, what we ended up doing in terms of incorporating it into Decred was we had a mixing process that we referred to as stake shuffle, and that's like a particular implementation of something called coin shuffle, which was proposed back in 2017. Maybe it's 2016.
I don't want to break your flow, but can you define what you use the shuffle for? So a lot of our audience may not be deeply into crypto. What do you need a shuffle for?
So one of the major problems with blockchains, like if we look at, you know, Bitcoin, is that there's no privacy or there's very limited privacy. So if people want to trace you on the blockchain, if you have two data sets, you can figure out an enormous amount about what's going on something like the Bitcoin blockchain or prior to privacy, the Decred blockchain. And so the way this works is that you can follow transactions on chain, and this would be referred to as on-chain analysis. Once you combine that with data from KYC AML, you know, organizations like centralized exchanges, then you can basically trace people's coins, all over the chain. And this is a problem. So one way that people have addressed this privacy issue is to do something called coin join. So normally, if I'm spending coins, I would spend, you know, some UTXOs, unspent transaction outputs. I would spend those, and then let's say I sent them to Patrick, and then I'd send the change from the transaction, that is the leftover amount, back to myself. And then what you can do is then you can start to follow and trace these things. That is that you can guess, is one of these outputs, is one of these outputs change? Is one of these outputs paying someone? And then the way to thwart that would be, let's say, you know, me and Cyprian said, hey, let's fool these people who are analyzing the blockchain. Let's work together to create transactions where we join our coins so that you can't apply the same heuristics to trace the change and then trace what, you know, what is a payout and what is change. So for example, if we merge our transactions, you can't tell if the change is going to Cyprian or it's going to me. And so that's called a coin join. And then if you build upon that, you can, there are a variety of ways you can do coin joins and build coin join transactions that are non-custodial. So no one takes custody of the coins except the people who are involved. And the way that the coin join, the outputs are ordered is also private. And that's effectively what coin shuffle is.
So it's like going into Grand Central Station to lose a tail.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So it's like going into Grand Central Station to lose a tail in a specific way that involves solving a system of equations such that it's prohibitively difficult to determine, yeah, you know, who went where, just like you're
just like encryption.
Out.
Just like encryption. Interesting. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to break your flow, but I think it's important that we understand exactly, you know, what's the goal of these things. Do you want to continue with what you're saying?
Yeah, sure. So that gives you some context on coin shuffle. It's a system for creating coin join transactions that makes it difficult to determine where the coins are going. So, for example, if all three of us participated in a coin shuffle transaction, there are outputs, and each of the three of us basically includes a payout address that you know, basically there's a mixed output that goes out for each of us. As long as we have at least two honest, at least two honest parties who don't collude, then the rest of the parties can't infer who owns the remaining outputs. And so it creates plausible deniability, like creates an n-fold plausible deniability. If there's n peers involved and n outputs, you can't tell which of the n is, you know, belongs to someone. Right. So the purpose of this is to add privacy on the blockchain. And what we saw was that this process involves, you know, with the basic cryptographic primitives, is involves hashes, it involves PKI, and then the PKI is used to create session keys. And then the session keys are used to basically encrypt a blob that everybody stitches together to create a system of equations. And that's how the process works. Well, I mean, as you guys might be able to observe, and the same might go for some of your listeners, that creates an easy, low-hanging opportunity to go post-quantum. That is that because you use the PKI to create session keys, you can just replace not post-quantum secure PKI system. You can replace that with a PQ one, and then you can generate session keys that way. And all it does is it adds an extra step in the communication process for setting up that coin join transaction. So we went ahead and we did that, and that's low hanging fruit. And here's the other bonus is that it didn't require any consensus changes on our chain. And this process effectively occurs off chain. So we were able to do it without incurring the usual costs that are involved with, with doing this stuff on chain.
Nice.
That's very interesting. That plugin that you mentioned, right? There is a lot of hype around quantum computing. And one of the things that I really hate is when I hear like, oh, quantum computing is going to replace everything we do with classical computing, right? Which is obviously borderline stupid. What will actually happen though is we will have some specific use cases where using either quantum computing or quantum communications where we would benefit a lot. And I believe one of the areas where in general, but also in particular the world of the Bitcoins and the distributed ledgers will benefit from is the improvements in terms of key exchanges, right? We're already having like proven ways of doing key exchange on quantum secured communication channels. And I think to your point, right, this is something that can be easily plugged into existing stacks, right? You don't need to change like the whole thing. If you can provide a secure way, like a secure in a physics way, secure way to exchange those keys, right? Then getting a symmetric encryption key is something that doesn't need to change from my point of view. If it's large enough, right, then and it will work. So I think there's an interesting kind of synergy here in the fact that there are threats, yes, but I think there's a lot of stuff to benefit from in the world of blockchains from some of these advancements, especially in the area of securing communications and establishing encryption keys and things like that.
Well, I think one of the benefits that maybe you guys did realize is modularity, is we have to learn that you can't build on a foundation of something that might develop a vulnerability, such as encryption. And we see quite a lot of people are just building everything around their encryption and into the encryption. So that's, it's a real Y2K problem. We call it Q2K, I think, sometimes. That you've built the encryption so deeply in darkly into the system that it's too painful to rip it out. And I mean, you're using NTRU. If you discovered there was a new modification, the more modular you make that, the better off you'll be. And so these are lessons that are hard won, but we seem to have to keep learning them.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild to see the way people have been deploying cryptography to both of your points. I mean, people lean really hard into the homomorphic property that I've called out a few times, to the point where, let's say, I don't know, tomorrow or next year, they go, oh, your PKI system's broken. Then they're up the creek without a paddle, and then they can't, they can't switch it out. So it's like, oh, this whole tech stack you've built is hosed as soon as your PKI system is blown. And we've been trying to do that, basically stay away from putting our other blockchain tech too deeply into that same bucket, right? Yeah. Everybody else is like, oh no, we're going to go hard with Taproot and stuff. And we're like, it's cool. But if it goes bad, then your whole stack is missed.
Well, cloud is going big on homomorphic as well, because just to define for the audience, homomorphic encryption, is my understanding, is encryption that allows you to do analysis without decrypting the data. And therefore, it's very, very enticing for some of the uses like you describe, but also for cloud computing, because as a cloud provider, if I can keep the data encrypted but still provide analytical access, then that requires less trust and less risk in the chain. So homomorphism is a big deal when it comes to encryption, and so I understand why that's something you guys would value.
I guess there's something to point out here too, which is that there's a bit of an overloaded term, right? So there's the homomorphic property that people use with elliptic curve crypto, and then there's fully homomorphic encryption, which is something different, right? So so in the context of blockchains, people use the homomorphic property of elliptic curve crypto very heavily, but that's distinct from the fully homomorphic encryption where that you guys are talking about in a cloud computing context, where it's like, doing basically inferring things from encrypted data held by a third party.
So right? Then what are you doing with that feature? What is the advantage to you then?
Well, it allows you to have things scale logarithmically that otherwise might not. Like, let me give you an example. Probably the simpler example would be range proofs. So when you deal with something like Monero, which uses confidential transactions take all of the amounts involved and make them opaque, right? And then in order for that to work, you need to basically encrypt, or in this case, hash the values, the values in question. But then, because cryptocurrencies were dealing with strictly positive numbers, you don't want somebody to start including negative numbers in there, right? So it's like, if 1 + 2 + 3 = 6, okay, that's reasonable. But you also want to make sure that every one of the elements 1, 2, and 3, none of those are negative. Right. So what you then need to do is, then you need a range proof for each of the elements that you're adding. And then those range proofs, one of the draws to the range proofs, and one of the reasons that it actually works out pretty well for something like Monero or anyone else who's doing confidential transactions, is that there is a logarithmic scaling to the range proof size. So the range proof can be kept small using the homomorphic property of elliptic curve crypto. And that's how people are really beating it up in terms of the stuff that we see in the blockchain space.
That's very different than what I was assuming. So I'm glad you explained that.
I'd like to bring to the table another interesting aspect. So we essentially, when we think about blockchain, right? One of the leading approaches is still proof of work, right? And for of course proof of stake is gaining popularity, and then all the others. But with proof of work, it's interesting that when you think about the mining process, right, at the end of the day, we're essentially talking about a brute force solution to that complex mathematical problem, right? And here's where potential advancements, like, for instance, a Grover search algorithm from the field of quantum can significantly disrupt that process. And I think this is one of the other, in addition to encryption and the attacks on the attack vectors around the algorithms, right? The fact that proof of work might be under threat from this time huge optimizations, right, is, I think, another very, very interesting area where I've seen a lot of talk and a lot of discussion, because this is going to impact kind of like the core of the, in the case of BTC, for example, right, it's going to impact the core of the whole blockchain maintenance process. Granted, we're not there yet, right, but I've talked to quite a number of people who are involved in the mining business itself, right? And there's concern there, because obviously it could, let's say, hinder the balance. And to your point, Jake, that kind of disruption, or the disruptor, to be more exactly, could be the type of entity, like a government entity, that would essentially destroy the balance in this field. I would really like to see, like, how do you see this part of the potential kind of interaction between quantum and blockchain?
Well, so one thing I'll point out that kind of stands out as interesting is people, most people aren't aware that the original Satoshi Nakamoto coins are almost all P2PK, so pay to pub key. Now, what's notable there, of course, is that the pub key is exposed. So if someone had a quantum computer, that's pretty low-hanging fruit, right, to steal those coins. And then there's all kinds of sort of secondary things you could do, like you could pretend you're Satoshi Nakamoto and use that authority to, you know, influence people. So there's a variety of – there's that, and I see that as kind of bait. And then in the context of proof of work, I mean, my view on proof of work is substantially different than a lot of people in the cryptocurrency space. We started with 60-30-10 in terms of, like, proof of work, proof of stake, and treasury split for Decred. We've since shifted it to 10-80-10, and this is because we've found out the hard way that proof of work, not only are there these sort of, you know, these Grover algorithm vulnerabilities that you pointed out, but it's also hyper centralized. Most yeah. people aren't aware of that, because there's this monolithic narrative that proof of work is decentralized. And it's like, maybe prior to 2013, that was mm-hmm. the case. And since then, it's basically, if you don't know the right people in China or Taiwan, you are never going to make it in the mining game. And that's what it really comes down to.
And you're not going to make money from the mining game at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, if you don't have your machines in the place with the cheapest power, which is, like, you know, effectively geographical arbitrage, and, you know, you don't have, and you're not, like, super close to the silicon, that is, you know, you work at Bitmain or you work for another one of these, people who gets these units fabricated, you're not going to make it. So I think the irony, right, is that you're pointing out that proof of work is, eventually, proof of work will have a very like a reckoning. That is, that the narrative that it's decentralized, which I personally have, you know, I haven't bought into for quite some time, is going to be shattered at some point once sufficient quantum computing power is available for the task.
And so, I think go ahead.
I'm just, like, inferring a very interesting conclusion from what you're saying, Jake, is that while proof of work might be at risk, it very well could be that by the time that risk would materialize, proof of work would be essentially almost a thing of the past, right? I'm not making predictions here, but...
it's out of favor, like, shall we say.
The evolution that you mentioned from 70 plus to 10, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. kind of shows it in a very, very clear way to me that... and that we know, like... I think it was last year, right, when Ethereum went from proof of work to proof of stake, right? So, mm-hmm. And I wonder, like, just, I know this has nothing to do with quantum, but and we don't like to do like guessing in the wind, but I'm just wondering, like could we see a day where, for instance, Bitcoin would consider moving from proof of work to proof of stake?
I think anything's possible. I think that Bitcoin maximalists would have a very hard time psychologically with that transition because people have leaned so hard into the, you know, into the proof of work is fair and proof of work is the best. And it's like, well, proof of work has worked for Bitcoin because they were first, right? So mm-hmm. they got a lot of mining in and a lot of the sort of the permissionless distribution part without the, oh, there's basically a mining farm in, you know, in the mountains in China, and it's basically churning out all your coins, and then they can do whatever they want with it. So, you know, I think the narrative at this point is monolithic, and a lot of people would struggle to be okay with such a transition, despite the fact that, in my opinion, at this point for me and for Decred in particular, I think that it's proof of work is toast. Proof of work is just a way to give coins to the wrong people who are going to attack your project. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so upping up the discussion a little bit, this is something that we've seen a lot when discussing like the potential impact of quantum computing with existing solutions. Like in many cases, the threat, so to speak, quote unquote, of quantum is real, but current systems in classical computing are under threat by so many other things that could kill them by the time quantum will become like a real, real threat, right? That it is always like a game of, and this is something that we also discuss quite a lot with Patrick and with our guests, is a game of how much of this quantum thing is actually hype versus how much is real. Because unfortunately, like every single time in the industry when we had something powerful being developed, it came with a lot of hype. And sometimes even the hype essentially destroyed the whole thing because it created totally unrealistic expectations. Like that's how we got, like, I'm doing a lot of work in AI, right? That's how we got the famous AI winters when like hype went through the roof. People were like expecting to see robots fighting on the streets by the 2000s, right? And then it was all of the sudden, oh gosh, we don't have the hardware to even train like the simplest neural network. And then you go like for a decade or so, like all funding is kind of drying up and interest is kind of going down, right? And at some point there is someone thinking like, oh my gosh, we have these things that we play games on, these graphic cards, so couldn't we use them for something? And then things explode, and now you have ChatGPT kind of rumbling all sorts of stupid things to people. So it's very interesting that, and I think the world of blockchain in general, right, of permissionless is especially a good example, because by the time quantum will have like any significant impact, we might see a lot of other things either kind of go out of fashion or being forced out of fashion, or some other new things coming to play, right? Because yeah, at the end of the day, if you look at the largest problems with ledgers and with blockchains, right, some of the most kind of And I would even say a word, the word ridiculous problems, right, were in, say, I don't know, contracts, smart contracts, where like obvious bugs were exploited by folks who were like draining out sometimes tens of millions of dollars worth of coins and assets, right? That's not quantum threat, right? No. That's like just like sound software engineering, which is sometimes missing, right?
For sure. I mean, this, you know, it's a major problem. I mean, the problem you described is super generic when it comes to tech, right? There's the hype and there's the reality. And so there's the tech and the hype. And so the hype always like leads the tech. And the reason is because, you know, comprehension is in short supply. Most people can't comprehend what the tech actually does. So they're right, like, whoa, did you see that marketing video? Like, oh, it's made my head explode, dude. And then it's like, then people start wigging out about, oh, this is so awesome, or oh, it's going to be the next thing. And then, you know, just like you're saying, you turn the corner and you're like, but who needs a coin for dentistry? Who needs dental coin? You know, like, so it's this thing where it's like the hype becomes like so ridiculous that, you know, people get excited about anything. They're like, I'm going to buy the dental coin and become a trillionaire. And it's like, dude, there's only so much dentistry to do. How do you think that's going to be worth $1 trillion? Oh man, it's going to go up. Everybody has teeth, man. Don't you realize the market share? I mean, it's like,
It sounds like you're recounting a conversation you've had.
this happens every like 3 or 4 years in the blockchain space. It's like constant. Yeah. I mean, just like you're saying with the AI space.
Yeah.
I'm going to pay my Starbucks coffee with 0.000001 Bitcoin. And then I'm going to pay a transaction fee that is 5 times larger than that. Right. It's like, cool.
We're starting to get long on time, but we do want to make sure you cover the things that you want to cover, Jake. You know, I'm sorry to, I'm always the down, you know, the downer. But what do you guys, I mean, you've described what you're doing in the beginning. You know, what should we be looking for? What are you guys up to next? Anything you want to highlight before we sign off?
So what we're up to next is that we decided that, you know, especially against this backdrop of sort of, you know, the censorship industrial complex on social media, we decided to address that. I have a lot of opinions that I end up getting that are not approved opinions, I think would probably be the most polite way to say it. And as a function of that, you know, my ability to reach people on social media, and same for the project, the project's account was basically, however this happened on Twitter, like blacklisted in late 2017. And as a function of that, I'm very skeptical of these existing models of social media because they take custody of your data. So what we've decided to build a network on top of Decred that uses Lightning Network, where all of the data transfers are paid for using, you know, Lightning Network transactions on Decred. And what we do is that instead of, say, communicating openly where it's like I send you messages and then somebody on the server can see it, everything is encrypted, including them, and all the metadata is stripped down to a dead minimum. And what's relevant here, particularly for this podcast, is that the notion of identity and the key exchanges that we use to secure this, you know, this communications platform are post-quantum. So we use NTRU Prime as the basis for identity on this network, and we use it to set up secured double ratchets between all the endpoints that are involved. And this is called Bison Relay. So we've been working on this for a few years, and it's you know, it seems like it's going, it's growing, it's slow going because everybody wants to, you know, continue using the platforms they use. But you know, it's a when you're left with no options, you got to create options.
So is this a platform or something that platforms will use?
The idea would be that it's effectively a platform that's built. Think of it along the lines of a replacement for the web with social media tightly integrated along with money. So that, for example, any message that you send on the network, there's a small micropayment for it. Any message you receive, there's a small micropayment for it. And then if I send a message to a whole bunch of people, the server just sees data moving back and forth as opposed to metadata that.
So no advertising based, no selling of lists or any of that stuff.
No surveillance.
Very different model.
No surveillance. And, you know, the idea is to make people sovereign over their data. And I think that that's like a major societal problem. And I think that, you know, that's actually, if you ask why we did post-quantum, you know, post-quantum PKI, it's to make people sovereign over their data. And I think that that's an important sort of social and societal, you know, goal to have in mind, is to make people sovereign. Because when everybody's sovereign, you know, I think we have a better society. And what's the phrase? Was it good fences make good neighbors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an old saying.
I think the ownership of the data is one of the things that is probably the most misunderstood part of the whole social networks construct today. I would bet if you ask like regular users, north of 99% would wrongly assume that they own the data, which is essentially not true.
If you don't pay for the product, you are the product.
Indeed.
Yeah, you are the product. But I mean, this has been an amazing discussion because it's kind of like at the confluence of these two big things that are happening in our society. And I would say, Patrick, that if there's one thing that kind of stands out for me from this whole discussion is we start hearing people saying we've built these things and we've built them in a way to factor in potential evolutions in the quantum space. right?
Yeah.
Like, and we've already heard this maybe a few times, so it's kind of starting to pop up here and there. But it's a very interesting signal, if you ask me.
It's right? important.
We see people like in the case of Jake in the blockchain space, right, and in other areas as well. Like, we're starting to look at these things, mm-hmm. which is very interesting from my point.
It's encouraging. So I think we have to put a pin in it and maybe talk again later. Thank you for joining us, Jake. It was really great talking to you.
Thanks for having me on, you guys.
It's been a real pleasure, Jake.
Cheers.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.